This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer squad, and Jewish communities around the world are reeling from the Hanukkah attack on Bondi Beach in Australia. We now know that one of the victims was a Holocaust survivor, and the question for many is, will this be a turning point, a wake-up call for authorities about what happens, what can happen when there is no consequence for vandalism and intimidation of Jews, anti-Semitism that has been rebranded as anti-Israel protest, despite the fact that it targets those who have no say in what happens in Israel. And just last week, there was an act of anti-Semitic vandalism. It took place in a local seniors building where some Holocaust survivors also live. Can you imagine how they are feeling today? And on a positive note, as you heard in Jeremy's news, a new survey finds grandparents saving the holidays in the midst of the affordability crisis, stepping up to buy gifts for grandchildren, with a quarter of respondents saying that the grandparents spend more on this than the parents do.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'd like to welcome Liz West, host of the Afternoon Express, David Valentin, a principal at Liaison Strategies, and here in studio, Anthony Quinn, the president of CARP. Hello and welcome.
Good afternoon, Libby.
So should we start positive news or not? Anthony, I'll let you call the heads or tails.
Well, let's talk about the, I think the most important thing in the news that we just heard was the tragedy and the attacks in Australia and what that means for us here in Canada and I think across the Western world, where everyone has been facing what the rise of Islamist terror means for the last two decades and has seemed to gone unabated and picked up in recent years since the attack by Hamas into Israel. So it's something not new, unfortunately, Libby, and it's just another in a long list of religiously motivated orthodoxy who cannot countenance any pluralism. And right now the focus is on Jewish Australians, Jewish Canadians, Jewish Americans, but the same ideology is killing Nigerian Christians.
Exactly.
And it's killing,
yes,
Sri Lankan Christians, and it's killing LGBTQ folks because of their views, and it's killing Jews around the world. So I don't know.
Well, exactly. And Liz, kind of rebrand. I mean, there's always some excuse. So instead of saying kill all the Jews, they say globalize the Intifada. Well, what does that mean? Or from the river to the sea, what do you do with the Jews in between the river to the sea? They seem to be very successful at using our pluralism against us, Liz, and you've got to wonder where it ends.
Yeah, I think you make a great point. And also when you talked about consequences, I mean, this is, for me, it's a two-pronged issue. One what are the consequences that are meant to curb people's behavior in society? And if they're not strong enough and they're not clear, then people do what they want. But more importantly for me is the root cause of this kind of violence and hatred. And it's something that we constantly grapple with. But that is where we need to focus our attention. What is the root cause of this hatred? And what are we going to do about it as a society? Because no group or faction within a society deserves to have that themselves be a target to anybody else. But what is going on in the minds of this father and this son that they were prepared to lose their lives in order to do this? What is wrong? And why can't we deal with this hatred?
Well, what's going on in their minds, they found ISIS flags. The son had been investigated for 6 months, apparently, in 2019, for being allegedly being part of an ISIS cell. Well, it looks like he certainly was. So that's clear what was going on there. But David, one of the things that's happened in the midst of this is that a lot of people say, well, they don't like it, but they don't want to stand up to it because they might be called, I don't know, anti-Palestinian or whatever it is. Do you have any polling on whether people see this as a threat to our society as a whole?
Well, I think it's so difficult to unpack, and there's a lot of data out there which is conflicting. But what I will say is it's not just about people looking at the Gaza issue and saying, you know, we dislike Jews for that reason or we dislike Zionists for that reason. Choose your word. You know, we also see, I think all of us are to some extent aware of the assassination of Charlie Kirk. There is a whole host of people online creating content day in and day out, including some who are very well known, like Candace Owens, who, you know, their conspiracy theory is that the state of Israel assassinated and murdered Charlie Kirk. And this is the kind of content that you see online now from some influencers, not all influencers, on the far right. And no one is addressing that as well. And I think all of it breeds hatred, all of it breeds misinformation and disinformation. And at a certain point, you have to wonder, what can we do to stop these conspiracy theories? There's a freedom of speech issue, which we understand, but you know, spewing all of this hate into the atmosphere and not expecting that something's going to come back, I think is quite naive.
Well, yeah, so you've got it both on the right and on the left, and there is no question that online algorithms that just amplify, rage baiting, which apparently is one of the words of the year, that is partly responsible for where we find ourselves at.
The divide between progressives and conservatives in the U.S. and their ongoing social media battles, I think, are less involved in what we're talking about happening in Australia and in Canada and in the U.S. and in Europe, pardon me, where the supporters of Hamas and Hezbollah and Islamo-fascism have infiltrated the perhaps the freedom of speech to complain about Israel's political or the work of the IDF. But when they had the protest against Israel in Sydney, Australia, and they filled up the bridge with Australian citizens, there were Hamas flags and ISIS flags flying amongst that protest. And those are terrorist organizations that are committed to killing Jews and wiping out Western civilization.
And those symbols are supposed to be banned as well, but nothing happens. I mean, Liz, we've talked about this before. I mean, if you commit low-level crimes and nothing happens, whether it's an anti-Semitic act or whether it's just a crime, then it escalates.
Well, I think when you prohibit signs and you silence hate speech, you aren't eliminating the problem, unfortunately. All you're doing is removing it from the public eye. It still exists. That's the real problem, is the hatred that exists. And I will say that I think that when people are generally happy and feel peace in their lives, then they don't go looking for blame, and they don't go looking to join bandwagons to make up for what they don't have. So when you look around, there's a lot of unhappiness in society, economic, mental health issues, lack of resources, not obviously just in North America, but all around the world. And so it's going to foster this kind of behavior, regardless of what kind of laws and policing and rules we put in place. It will just hide what exists, and that is the bigger problem.
Well, yeah, and then social media does come into that, because it fosters isolation, it fosters anger, David. But you know, nobody seems to be able to do anything about anything.
Well, I think if there was an easy solution, we would have done it by now, right? I think the question of how do you combat hundreds of years of anti-Semitism is a difficult one, right? And I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. I'm not Jewish myself, but growing up, I had lots of Jewish friends. I went to bar and bat mitzvahs. We were coloring in Hanukkah menorahs and also Christmas trees at school. You learn about the community, and you know, if someone had said to me as a child, you know, Jewish people are evil or whatever you want to say, I would have been really like perplexed by the notion, because of being part of that community. I think what's happening now is, you know, we're so segregated in some ways, and we're not interacting with our neighbors in the same way that we used to. As you mentioned, we have this echo chamber of social media. We just want to talk with people who agree with us and who hype us up, right? And as a result, we're not meeting other community members. And I think that's where the real struggle is going to be. I think the solution is to, you know, make sure people are making those community connections, having those opportunities in Canada, whether it's employment or mental health access. But those are all really long-term things that are going to take tremendous amounts of time and effort and goodwill to get done, right? None of that is going to be easy. I think in the short term, you know, we hear from politicians that they can't give orders to the police. And there's a very good reason for that, right? I don't think we'd want to live in a society where they could order the police around. But at the same time, you have to wonder what is going on at the Ministry of the Solicitor General, that they're looking at all these things happening and they're still not giving the police the direction that they should take action on this.
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. And Anthony, it's also ironic that this happened just as Australia was trying to banning social media for teenagers until their age of 16.
Yeah, I'm still not convinced that this is a social media issue. I think it gets more down to the root of a small faction, but small still meaning millions of people around the world who have a hatred for Western culture and values, and they see in themselves the means by which they can fight it.
Well, but they've been so successful at co-opting so many others. And I think that their success, a lot of it is social media. I agree with you. It is that hardcore, basically terrorists. But how do you explain all of our Canadian college students, you know, who run around glorifying Hamas?
Well, I don't think that's a large population either. I think it's a small number. But I remember clearly not too long ago, but it was still before the infiltration of social media everywhere, that there were 90 people killed at a rock concert in Paris, and there was a bomb.
Oh, yes.
The bomb at a concert in London, and the murders on bridges in London. So there is this nonstop aggression that has gone on for decades, that is attempting to intimidate and fight against Western cultures and values. The focus now is on Israel and Gaza and Palestinians, but I think that has been fomenting for years. And there was an effort to fight ISIS and to fight the other extreme groups that were in Western cultures. It seems to have gone quiet.
Yes, that's true too. Okay, and a little later in the show, I'll be talking to representatives of Toronto's Jewish community about where we go from here. But let us move along.
Libby?
Well, yes?
Hello?
Hello?
Sorry, can I just jump in before we move topics?
Go Libby? Ahead. Yes.
Oh, good. I think there's a part of the story which is really important, the incident in Australia, and that is that a unarmed Muslim man disarmed one of the attackers, risked his own life, is paying for it now, in order to do what he saw was clearly the right thing to do. And I think that that is a super important takeaway from this incident. It's a remarkable story of bravery and having not seeing people as a religion, but as human beings being attacked.
Well, yeah, that absolutely, absolutely. And there are good people who are from all different groups, obviously. And yes, that is a positive part of the story. And we hope for the best for that that hero who has undergone surgery.
However, it sounds like he's going to be okay. So that's good news.
Yeah, yeah, that's very good news. And moving along to Christmas and this news that once again, I mean, we know that grandparents, a lot of grandparents who are not necessarily wealthy themselves are paying a lot of the bills for their adult children. But now it looks like, well, the grandchildren, too, and they're stepping in to cover the cost of Christmas to give the grandkids a lovely Christmas, Anthony.
Well, what better time is there for grandparents to flex their financial wherewithal to splurge on their grandchildren? Parents are dealing with the everyday bills of raising children, whether it's for sports or transportation or all the incidentals that go along with raising children. And this is the time where parents, grandparents, can step up and do a little splurging and help out those parents who are paying the bills 24/7. And I think this is one of the times where grandparents really feel that they get a little extra connection with their grandchildren over the holidays, and they're glad to spoil them with gifts.
Yeah, but do they get the credit for the gifts, or are the gifts from Santa or from mom and dad, even though grandma and grandpa pay?
I don't think they're looking for the recognition. They're just glad to see the smile on their grandchildren's faces, and it's not about who's paying, but they're able to contribute.
David, were you surprised by this?
No, we've seen research now pretty continuously that grandparents are chipping in more, whether it's helping the grandkids with the down payment for their first home, whether it's making sure that the family is able to go on vacations. You know, they have the resources and they're willing to use them. And this is a good time of the year to do it, right? It's really about family and making sure that you can support the ones you love.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's one thing for people who do have the resources, but there are lots of cases where the grandparents put their own retirement lives at risk in order to be able to help their families.
Well, I was going to say there's a couple of things that came up for me when I heard this story today. And one is that I'm glad to hear people aren't overextending themselves and spending what they don't have. And I interpreted that the grandparents that are chipping in more are doing it because they can. I don't think anybody, we already have like a massive amount of household debt in this province. We definitely don't need to be spending more than we have, but there's such huge commercial pressure. What a great opportunity to start teaching your kids about things other than buying. But also there's, you know, something that has been talked about more and more as of late is this idea of a living legacy. So my takeaway was really that, and I think Anthony mentioned it, it's wonderful to see the benefit of what you're passing along while you still can, versus waiting to die and not knowing, you know, the kind of joy or change you've made in the life of a loved one. So I do very much love that idea of using the wealth that you have while you can. I know it can be challenging, tricky, a lot of unknowns. Many people are in a position that they can't do that, in which case, don't do it. But if you can, then how great to see what change you can make in a person's life, whether it's young grandkids or maybe their early 20s, you know, looking for something that gives them a leg up as young adults, any number of things.
Well, there's an old Russian proverb, give while the hand is still warm, Anthony.
I think that applies for both for older adults who are putting money away for themselves for future travel or bucket list items. You never know how long you'll be able to actively get out there and enjoy what you've accumulated in life. So that's advice for anybody who has the opportunity. Take it while you have it. You don't know how long you have. But the ability to pass on and support children and grandchildren, that's why something like a reverse mortgage is growing in popularity now, because people have wealth, but they can't access it in their homes. So they take out a reverse mortgage, a little or a lot, and that can help with their grandchildren's education or their children to get their own house. So that kind of ability to access your own wealth, but still remain in your home, is why there's a new product like a reverse mortgage. And I think that's, we're seeing more of seniors looking to help out as they can. And that's one of the ways they do it.
Right. But we're also, again, we see seniors who endanger their own well-being and retirement in order to help their families, which, you know, is not a huge shock either.
No. And the reverse mortgage is certainly for a small niche of Canadians, but those who are, you know, house rich and cash poor can take advantage of that equity they've built up, and they can help themselves or they can help their family members.
Yep. It is definitely an option, though, financial advisors saying take a good look at it, because there can be pitfalls to that as well. So it's not just because, I mean, there's an affordability crisis, and everything, Liz, is so expensive. I know. I think you're giving your kids cash. That's that seems to be what young people want.
Oh gosh, they want cash 365 days a year, Libby. Not just Christmas. It is expensive, but you know, think about all the money that we're saving on food, because apparently nobody's eating anymore.
Oh, the GLP-1. That's right. Changing food habits. And I think we talked about this last week that. Gift cards are being seen as an inflation free, because you can still buy a $25 gift card for $25, even though it's going to buy a lot less, Anthony.
It doesn't go very far. I'm not sure what the inflation is like this year on toys and video games. I imagine it's going along with the flow. But the food inflation is really what's hitting families.
Yeah.
And you still have to buy the milk and the cheese and the bread and all those things that are eating away at your income every day. And what's left for the Christmas presents is the question. And that might be where the grandparents are coming in to help meet that the missing portion of the budget that what you were hoping to have for Christmas, but inflation has taken away.
And what is the amount? We had this conversation on the morning Zoom with Andy and Jane, and apparently a lot of people think a $50 gift card for a niece or nephew is still nice, though Andy and Jane said, we got to give more. What do you think, Anthony?
I think it's always based on what one can afford. It would be lovely to give $1,000 or $5,000.
No, but the number.
I don't think there's a number. I think it's based on what you can afford.
What are you giving your nieces and nephews?
I couldn't say, Libby. I have four daughters, and yeah. Instead of giving Christmas gifts this year, we're pooling all of our gift-giving money, and we're traveling to Florida for a vacation. So the gifts are flights and accommodations and food while we're there.
Okay. That sounds good. Liz, a number?
I'm a bit of a stodgy Scroogey. I still think 50, if someone gives me a $50 gift card or $50, I'm pretty happy. You get a couple of those, all of a sudden you've got $200. What is wrong with that?
Nothing. Nothing. Yeah. Absolutely nothing. I mean, I'm stodgy enough to think that cash is, it's kind of rude. I mean, you know, but
yes,
you can go wrong with a gift. I'm going to give David the last word on this. David, do you have a number?
Well, I usually try to avoid gift cards for my family, but, you know, $50-$75, depending on who they are and how close they are to me and how much I've seen them for the year. You know, I don't buy everyone the same kind of gift because I have a large family. My mom has six brothers and sisters.
Oh, so dear.
So if I were to give everyone $50, but no, we try to buy things that are nice for the people who are around. And, you know, we'll have our Christmas Eve on the 24th and I'll make sure I have something for everyone there.
Okay, Christmas Eve on the 24th. Well, I haven't even seen, I've ordered the turkey, but I haven't seen how much it costs, and I bet it's going to be plenty expensive, but that's okay. On that note, we're going to wrap things up, and we still have one more Zoomer Squad left before Christmas, and I look forward to that one. And I hope we have better news. Thank you so much, Liz West, Anthony Quinn, and David Valentin. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Libby.
Bye, Libby.
Happy Hanukkah, Libby.
Thank you. Okay, we're taking a break, and when we come back, we will be talking to some people inside the Jewish community about where we go from here when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, here at home, security around Jewish events and locations has been upped as the community celebrates Hanukkah. But the feeling that Jews are not safe here persists amid inaction around vandalism and intimidation and lower level violence that until now has had very few consequences, although these incidents have multiplied since the October 7th Hamas attack. So will there be more action now? Let's go to Rabbi Seth Gorin, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Hillel Ontario, and Richard Robertson, Director of Research and Advocacy at B'nai B'rith Canada. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show, Libby.
Well, this is a terrible day, terrible start to Hanukkah. Richard, what would you like to see from authorities that you have not been seeing until now?
Well, we need meaningful action in legislative change at all levels of government from the top down that demonstrate that our leaders understand the seriousness of the threat facing Jewish Canadians. We are experiencing a national crisis of anti-Semitism, and we need sufficient redress from all levels of government that such a crisis warrants. We also need to see the recognition from our leaders that, depending on the leader, their permissive attitude towards their silence or some of the positions that they've taken that have emboldened and incited the anti-Semitism in this country are unacceptable, and that they need a change of course, because as we're seeing around the world, first in Manchester and now in Sydney, when we create environments where anti-Semitism is normalized, Jewish lives are the cost.
Rabbi Gorin, what do you say?
I would agree with everything that that Richard shared. We've been waiting for years at this point for government officials at all levels to step up and to do their jobs in keeping Jewish Canadians safe, in keeping Israeli Canadians safe. And so far, they have been lacking. I do want to give a shout out to many of our partners in campus administration and in campus safety, many of whom have, especially as of late, found their voices and spoken out on behalf of Jewish students, staff, and faculty at universities and colleges in Ontario and across the country. But there needs to be more. There needs to be more action. And especially when it comes to ensuring that Jewish students, Israeli students, have as much right to be safe on campus as anyone else, there's a long way to go to make sure that that actually happens.
Okay, so let's get to specifics. I mean, security provided by the Toronto Police is being stepped up, Richard, and this time we have seen statements from all levels of government, something that has often been lacking. Practically speaking, what do you need to see?
Condemnations are welcome, but condemnations after the fact, Libby, do not solve the problem. And this crisis of anti-Semitism that we're witnessing, in part, is being driven by another societal problem we have in Canada, which is the growth of extremism and polarization. And we need our government to take it seriously. We need them to confront the vitriolic rhetoric that is permeating online. We need them to take significant action against the groups who are perpetrating the growth of extremism, because the growth of radicalization extremism is just a precursor to ideologically motivated violent extremism, and we simply can't afford to let it get to that point in this country.
Well, we have this new proposed hate law. It hasn't been passed. Is that going to do the trick?
Bill C-9 will provide new tools to law enforcement and to prosecutors to protect Canadians against some of the forms of hatred that we are seeing on our streets, but that's just a start. We need to recognize that extremism is having a profound impact on our society, and we need to develop additional legislation to confront it. Our online world is under-policed, and it leads us to be quite vulnerable.
Rabbi Gorin, I mean, again, let's talk practicality. What do we need on campus? I mean, at some of these demonstrations and encampments, we have slogans which amount to killing Jews, and we have Hamas flags, and nothing ends up happening.
So what I would say is that all we've been asking administration to do is to uphold their own policies in a way that allows Jewish students to participate fully in the life of the university. That's it. That all of these tools are great. If we're going to add to the arsenal that administrations have on campus, that's fantastic. But all of that is irrelevant and useless without the will to take action. Now again, I do want to give credit to people who have been standing up and who have been standing up with the Jewish community and have been there for Jewish students. But it's really, there's a twofold necessity. The first is to take action when something happens and to respond appropriately and to hold perpetrators accountable, whether they're people who are members of the campus community, whether they're people who come from off campus. In addition, there's an obligation to ensure that members of the campus community are educated about anti-Semitism as a way to prevent it in the first place. It's great to be able to respond when something happens, when there's an off-campus event that interlopers come in and violently disrupt it. That's great. If you're able to take action then, like, kol hakavod to you. And it's necessary to do things that help to prevent anti-Semitism from occurring in the first place.
Yeah, but a lot of this is fomented or mm-hmm. abetted by faculty, which are overwhelmingly anti-Israel. And we've had this rebrand where you can just call old-fashioned anti-Jewish hatred anti-Israel.
Mm-hmm. That's a huge problem. And one of the things that we've been pressing administrations to do is to recognize that you can't just go into a document and control find and replace anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish with anti-Zionism. That functionally on campus in this moment, they are equivalent. And so encouraging administrations and having administrations hold people responsible for anti-Semitism as if it is, excuse me, for anti-Zionism, as if it is anti-Semitism, which it currently is, that is necessary. You've hit on the rub, which is how to engage with faculty, how to hold faculty accountable, and not for there to be freedom of the pulpit, freedom of the podium as an excuse. And that is a tricky wicket, and we are pressing administrations to do far more in addressing anti-Semitism among faculty members.
Richard, I mean, in a lot of ways, our pluralistic democratic system is being used against us, and also the backlog in our court system. So we don't see a lot of charges because it's hard to charge under the current law. So let's even say that that gets sorted out a bit. What we often find, so somebody is charged. It's months and months before the case goes forward, and then the charges are quietly dropped. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I think that one of the things we need to focus on, Libby, is getting to these issues before they lead to court cases. We need to stop the division, the intolerance, the incitement, the emboldening in our society. I want to build on something that Seth mentioned, which is anti-Zionism. We have a definition of anti-Semitism in Canada, which makes clear that certain forms of anti-Zionism are anti-Semitism. We need, as a society, to come to terms with the fact that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And by acknowledging that, we can start to shift the narrative and we can handcuff some of those who use anti-Zionist rhetoric to unduly attack the Jewish people.
Right. But again, practically. So there's one of these hateful demonstrations. People are upset. I mean, it blocks traffic, but people kind of look away. So what happens at one of these demonstrations where you have hundreds of people, some of whom are paid, blocking roads, blocking access to hospitals? Like, so what practically happens to stop that?
Well, we need to ensure that we have laws in place and that those laws are being actuated upon. But we also need to change the tone in our society where, as a collective, we accept that it is not okay to be protesting in a residential neighborhood, that it is not okay to subject a minority cohort of society to vitriolic protests on a recurring weekly basis. Yes, we need changes to our laws, and yes, we need those laws to be enforced, but we also need a whole of society approach. We now need to take a stand as Canadians and say, no, this is not acceptable. This is not aligned with Canadian values.
Well, yeah. And Rabbi Gorin, I think a lot of people, I mean, we used to have that consensus. They're afraid of being branded as Islamophobic or racist or whatever.
I mean, what I would say is that from polls I've seen of the Canadian public, that people do believe that this type of demonstrating, that this type of confrontation, incitement to violence is un-Canadian. And what it takes is for people who are in positions of authority to use their authority to do what everyone wants them to do, which is to uphold the law, to ensure that people who violate the law are held accountable for what they've done, whether it's blocking traffic, whether it's vandalizing a building, whether it's breaking into space that you have no right to be in, and destroying property. Like, these are crimes. These are violations of the law. And we would call upon people who are in positions of authority to uphold the law and to prosecute people to the extent possible.
Okay, we're out of time. Last yes or no question to Richard. Do you think this will be some kind of turning point? Are you confident in that or not?
It needs to be. We need this to be a wake-up call. The Jewish community has been pointing out to our leaders and to our society for far too long the dangers of creating an environment where anti-Semitism is permissive, and we must use the Australian example as a lesson.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Richard Robertson and Rabbi Seth Gorin. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Libby.
Thank you. And we're taking a break. And when we come back, fascinating genealogical technology that police used to solve three cold cases when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Last week, police identified Kenneth Smith as the murderer in three cold cases of homicide, which happened between 1982 and 1997. The DNA technique, forensic genetic genealogy, was used to identify him as the killer of Christine Prince, Gracelyn Greenidge, and Claire Sampson. Now, to tell us more about this fascinating technology, Detective Sergeant Steve Smith with the Toronto Police Service. Detective Sergeant, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Grace.
It's Libby speaking, by the way. How does this technology work? How did you end up being able to identify the perpetrator?
So, the way we use DNA in criminal cases is it's sequenced in a sort of way to give us a one-to-one comparison that we can use in court. What we do in genetic genealogy is we sequence it in a different way that allows us to use familial ties in order to identify family relations of the offender, the unknown offender that had left his DNA at the crime scene. And that's exactly what we did in this case.
So you need to find a family member first. So how did that work? Who did you find? I mean, without identifying them, what kind of a relative? And how are you able to use that?
So basically how it works is once we sequence it in the different type, it's called a SNP, a single nucleotide polymorphism, we can upload that SNP to certain genealogy websites in the U.S. One is GEDmatch, the other is Family Tree DNA. Those are the only two that allow us to upload as police officers. When we do upload, then what we get in return is a list of relatives out to six cousins. And anybody that's uploaded to those systems that is related to our unknown profile will allow us to start building a family tree to determine where in that family our offender is.
Okay, so you were able to do that. And then once you find a person, do they have to agree to submit their DNA, or how does that work?
So usually it'll bring us into a family. So we'll have a family of people that could have left this DNA at the scene. From there, we go back to traditional policing. We either execute a DNA warrant, we ask people to voluntarily provide their DNA, and or we find another way to gather their DNA. In this case, the person was deceased, so we had to write a warrant for some genetic material that was kept from his autopsy, and that's how we were able to determine that he was, without a doubt, our offender.
And again, with the family, was it a distant cousin that you first found, or what kind of level of relative?
Yeah, there's all kinds of different relatives on there, and most of them are distant, out around, you know, starting about second cousin and out to as many as sixth cousins. So we're able to bring it from being that far away and determine, using both maternal matches and paternal matches, to show us where our family of interest lies.
And how long did that process take with this case?
So this case, I mean, it's been a long process. We've been working on since 2017. We first engaged genetic genealogy in 2022, but we had a complex mixture of DNA, so it wasn't until 2025 that we were actually able to get that DNA to a point where it was useful to us with SNP testing. And once we did, it actually went pretty quickly because of matches on the maternal side and the paternal side. It very quickly led us to the family of interest.
Uh-huh. What do you mean by a complex mixture of DNA?
So one of the things that holds us back in some of our cold cases is that because we've had a fight or a stabbing or that sort of murder, we get sometimes the offender's DNA mixed with the victim's DNA. And to be able to sequence it, we have to be able to separate the offender's DNA from the victim's DNA and sole source our offender's DNA to get them up on the websites. If you have a mixture, it doesn't really work because it'll give you false positives in regards to the family members.
Now, the family members of the women who were murdered, what kind of reaction do you usually get when they get a name after all of this time?
Yeah, I mean, every family's different, but mostly when we are able to call them and tell them that we know the person that committed this offense against their loved ones, it's usually a very favorable reaction. I mean, it's very emotional, obviously, especially after all these years, not knowing whether this would ever be solved or not. And I mean, in reality, if a close member of your family is killed, there's probably a lot of suspicion on people around that person. So to find out it's somebody that wasn't related and or a friend of the deceased really makes a difference to the families.
And in this case, you know, there was one case a few years ago where the perpetrator was alive and charged. This case, he died back in 2019. How does that impact things?
Yeah, I mean, it's frustrating for probably, well, it is frustrating for investigators. It's also most likely frustrating for the families, because they don't see this person actually have to come before the justice system and hear and, you know, be sentenced for what they did. So, I mean, it is great to know who it was, but it's a bit bittersweet knowing that they're already deceased and they don't have to face justice for the crimes that they committed.
And you're looking at this person, Kenneth Smith, possibly he's responsible for some other involved murders as well. Is that right?
Well, we want to make sure that we aren't missing anything. I mean, we want to cover every minute that he wasn't in jail, and we want to make sure that he wasn't committing any other sexually based offenses and or murders in those times. So we want to speak to anybody that may have known Kenneth, anybody that had any involvement with Kenneth, and anybody that may have been victimized by him that at the time they didn't feel comfortable coming forward, but they do now.
And I'm looking at these three victims, three women, and beyond the fact that it was a sexual nature of the crime, is there anything, any commonality among these three murders?
There was not. I mean, they were very different women, different lifestyles, different ages, different ethnicities. It was everything in these cases was very different. It seems like it was crimes of opportunity for our offender. So, however, he came upon these women and they were susceptible at that time, he took advantage of that and abducted and or sexually assaulted the women.
Wow. It's that I'm sure that complicated the solving as well.
Yeah, it was very difficult. I mean, when you looked across the three women, they lived very different lives. And of course, we go over everyone that was involved in any of their lives, but there was nothing that overlapped for us. And it was it actually gave us three different distinct kind of persons of interest to look at. So we had a lot of people that we were looking at. We were able to clear a good portion of those. And when we identified Mr. Smith, he wasn't on our radar for these offenses.
Wow. How many cases do you have in a backlog that you're hoping to solve this way?
So in Toronto, for homicides, we have over 800 unsolved homicides. We also have about 32 unidentified human remains to still identify, and we have probably upwards of 500 to 1,000 sexual assaults, and that's just in Toronto.
How many do you get through, say, in a year?
Well, we're lucky enough to have funding from the Ontario government. The Solicitor General's office has provided us funding to utilize this technique. And we try to put forward about 36 cases a year if we can, depending how far the money stretches for us. And right now we're at close to a 50% solve rate on those cases that we're putting forward.
That's incredible. What would you like to leave us with about this technology?
Just that it's made unsolvable cases solvable again. I mean, a lot of these cases that have gone cold over the years, we can now go back, readdress them, retest, find offender DNA, and it doesn't matter how old it is, we can either identify somebody that's previously been unidentified, or we can identify an offender that committed offenses from long ago.
That must be very satisfying.
Yeah, our investigators are thrilled, and every time that we can solve another one of these cases and notify the families, it's an amazing feeling for everybody involved. As we said, we'd like to see people have to face justice, but if they are deceased, it is still good to identify them and know who the offender was.
Fascinating. Thank you so much, Detective Sergeant Steve Smith. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right. That is all the time we have for today. I'll be back here tomorrow with our political panel, our Recovering Politicians panel. And on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer, we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.